So here we are today. This is Our Curious World. My name is Christian Under. Thanks for taking the time to join me here today. I'm joined today by Pippa King, who has made quite a name for herself in terms of the internet in regards to a place where people can find out about the surveillance that have happened to our children in schools. And that really is the basis of why I first spoke to her initially at a conference at AV7 that happened a couple of years ago. And we just broke into conversation. We've kept in touch ever since. And this really is a let's talk about it, because I guess people aren't perhaps aware. So, Pippa King, how are you doing? You all right?
I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks very much for coming on, really, because I came across your website maybe a little bit before AV7 when I was just searching RFID being utilized in schools. And I was kind of curious about it. And then when I met you, I was like, oh, that's actually the person I need to talk to. And so, really, how did you get into this? How? Because I guess you came at it from a very different angle to say how some people would have a very conspiratorial kind of mind. You came at it from a parental point of view, is that right?
Yes. So basically, my interest in how schools surveil and use technology with children came from my two children going to primary school and me spotting a fingerprint reader in the library. So this was way back in 2005, and really the technology wasn't at all prolific in adult society, and it really wasn't prolific in the educational society. It just so happened that I had read an article 2 weeks earlier on the internet about fingerprint readers in libraries to enable children to wander in and out of libraries and not to have to queue and get their books signed in and out. And I can remember reading the article and thinking, crikey, that's, I couldn't possibly think it's a good idea to use fingerprint systems in libraries,
What?
Anyway, 2 weeks later, there it was. There was a little fingerprint reader. And I know no other parent would have known what that was, but it just so happened, because I was on the PTA, that I recognised it. So I asked the head teacher, when are you going to ask for permission to take my children's fingerprints? And she just said, don't need permission, we're just going to take them. I thought, no, you're not. So I kicked up in a hell of an almighty stink. Not particularly at the school. I mean, I just told the school point blank that they weren't going to fingerprint my kids, and I put that in writing. And other parents started to sort of think, okay, this is a bit weird, because it was a strange technology sort of way back in 2005, because nobody was using it. Why would kids, primary school children use it? So I wrote to the education secretary, the shadow education secretary, the leader of the council where I was, and just say, did you know this was happening? And the answers were no, because basically schools don't, they operate as sort of little single authorities in their own right. They get their own budgets, so basically they're accountable to nobody but themselves. As long as they're not breaking the law, the DfE says they can basically do what they want, Department of Education. So turned out this technology was in quite a few schools in the UK back in 2005, and there were some parents that were concerned about it. So what I did was I got back in, went back on the website and looked at my history, and went back to the website that initially had done this article on biometric fingerprint readers in schools, and got in touch with the author to see how prolific it was, because it had happened to me. And she said that she had had a couple of calls from concerned parents from Cambridge, Wales, Scotland, different places, but it was very scattered. So she said, do you want to coordinate the parents to sort of, and we'll try and see if we can get some discussion going in Parliament about it. So I said, yeah, sure. So very loosely and in a completely unorganised way, because we were all sort of in different parts of the country, and there was no sort of Twitter or, well, there was Twitter and social media, but we weren't on it. We were still communicating by email and landline telephones. And we organised ourselves and spent from 2005 to 2010, once or twice, three times a year, going to Parliament and talking to MPs about the technology and why are they fingerprinting children without telling parents
So
or asking.
what was your responses from the MP? So who you told that to?
So at the time, the Labour government was in control. They were in Parliament, they were in the country, and the education Department of Education, their line was just simply, if schools aren't breaking the law, we're not interested in what they're doing in schools. And they weren't breaking the Data Protection Act, because the Data Protection Act was dated 1998, and there was no provision for biometrics in that Protection Act, because
Is
biometrics
this
were.
another situation where technology is moving faster than the law is moving, really, isn't it? So, because I'm aware that a lot of the schools in the UK certainly now are more, they're no longer independent. They're almost groups of academies, effectively.
Yeah, you can get what they call multi-academy trusts, MATs.
Yeah, that's right.
Get one sort of super head that oversees the whole lot. So essentially, it's like one big school with different campuses.
Yes.
And they're, I would say less accountable. They're still subject to freedom of information, but they don't. I get the feeling that they don't like being asked questions. Really, the local authority schools are a lot more easy to deal with, in my experience.
Anyway. Well, I guess because I guess if you're a state school, you are still kind of subject to the state, as well. If you're a private business, who is subject to yourself, I guess. I guess you.
I mean, the people that run multi academy trusts aren't in it purely just because they want to see kids get a good education. There isn't going to be lots of money to be made.
Yeah, because I'm not actually currently sure how they work. I mean, is it the government has gives them money every year per child? Is that how it works?
that's generally how it works. Anyway, I think each child used to about 10-15 years ago have about £2,500 on its head. Now it's a little bit more. I think it's sort of going up to £4,000. I don't know the exact figure. So as many kids as they can get through those front doors as possible means that particular a trust or school gets that budget.
Yeah. I always think of it a bit like prisons. You know, a prison is therefore running for profit. Therefore, the more prisons they have in, the more money they get. And if it's a for private run business, it's about what's your bottom line. And now, it's a weird way to think, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, as well, with academies and preschools, they don't have to employ qualified teachers.
Oh, really?
So immediately, you can. Which is, you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I mean, qualified teachers are very good. They know what they're doing. I do think there's an argument to say that if somebody's teaching a subject, they should have had 5 years in industry first before they sort of stand in front of the classroom and talk about a subject that they've had no operational knowledge of.
Oh, man.
Having said that, it also means they can employ whoever they want, with whether they're good teachers or bad teachers. I mean, I guess it's they need people that are going to get kids to sit exams. So they're not going to employ bad teachers, but I don't know. I mean, I'm a teacher and I'm unqualified, so I don't have a teaching certificate as such, but I teach music and teach piano for a living.
I've got to tell you a story just popped in my head just then. A few months ago, there was this, I talked to a lot of different people on Facebook and social media and so on. And there was a particular post that came up, and it was by a woman who says, could someone point me in the direction of some knowledge about Norse mythology? I'm going to be running a class on it for the next 6 months, but I don't know anything about it. And I'm like, what? I was like, how can you be getting paid as a teacher to teach Norse mythology if you don't know nothing about the topic or subject yourself? And what that person is going to find is found on Google or found in one single book as opposed to any complimentary or conjecture information from lots of different sources. And I'm like, how can you teach that? And I wonder why the school quality is going down.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, because of what happened with the fingerprinting in my son's primary schools, they both went through primary and I learned through lobbying the government and knowing the education system and part of education, I just thought that there's enough of that. They came out at primary and we home educated for secondary. So, I know an awful lot of school teachers and you know, the curriculum changes like that, and you know, there are quite a lot of school teachers, even though they're qualified, will find themselves teaching topics and subjects that are off topic for them, because it just so whether you're qualified or not, I don't know, maybe it's irrelevant, but certainly qualified teachers cost an awful lot more than unqualified teachers, so I would
so it's a cost it's a cost measure, isn't it?
Academies probably have a lot more unqualified teachers in them than qualified ones, plus the fact if you are an academy or a free school, you're not obliged to have unions. So you could, the teaching conditions, work conditions are different from state schools.
That opens up some interesting conversations as well, doesn't it? About what could be taught, what is being taught, the quality of the teaching. Because I guess if the person's just an unqualified individual, have they had the experience to teach in front of a class of what is now 35 to 38 people on average? Particularly when there's one person might be disruptive or whatever, how can they manage to deal with that situation? Crazy.
Well, it was interesting because when the first academies sprung up, one of the first academy groups or set of academies was in the northeast, and it was the Reg Vardy Academy. Now, Reg Vardy is a used car dealer.
Basically. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and he's a very obviously born again Christian. He's very Christian. So he was teaching what do you call it? It wasn't Darwinism.
No, creationism.
Yeah, he was teaching the biblical side of that's how we the world. Sort of existed. So all the kids that, you know, I think there was sort of maybe three or four schools, we went and taught the Christian version of how mankind came to exist.
Like dinosaurs have only been dead for 6,000 years.
Well, that's it, yeah. So dinosaurs, you know, that's a myth.
It's crazy because I guess if you have a school that essentially has a free book to write what it wants, and I guess there must be certain basics that a school must cover. You must teach about 4 hours of English, math, science a week, whatever. But apart from that, you've got a free range to teach these children what you like. I mean, that's a very dangerous precedent.
Yeah, I think there are basic stuff. I mean, I don't know. I don't actually teach in schools now, but I think there must be sort of basic tick boxes that you must do to sort of say to be a multi-academy trust or an academy. So we're going to follow the curriculum, but within, we're going to teach religion, but within that box, we can do what we want.
Yeah.
So because they don't necessarily have to run it as a GCSE or as a qualification, but they can run it as a topic that you don't need to. For example, there's a school, a primary school in Bradford. I think sort of 96% of its population were not speaking English as a first language, and it was in real dire straits. They were having some difficulties, and a new head teacher came in and decided that he would up music to 5 to 8 hours a week, compulsory for everybody. And within 2 years, the school had turned around significantly. It was in the top 20 schools with the most sort of improved results because the school had found a common language that everybody spoke, regardless of what they were doing, but it brought them together. They weren't sort of in groups or factions in playgrounds or in lessons. They suddenly were working together as a team. And that
So
psychological sort of, but also as well, music has a very interesting effect on the brain. I mean, being a musician, I'm very much into the sort of physics and the harmonies of it and the frequencies. So it's really interesting the effects that music can have on the brain. So, and he's absolutely right. It feeds the soul and it gets your brain up and running. So good for him. So he had the opportunity to do that. So it's good.
yeah, that sounds like good practice actually, because obviously music is a, although it's written, it's an unspoken language at the same time. It's a language that everyone can understand regardless of where you come from. And I guess that draws communities together, it works, encourages people to work together. Yeah, I can see exactly why that would work. I mean, that's an ideal teaching situation, I guess, because they had perhaps the freedom to teach, a kind of a loose curriculum, should we say, in their school that worked for them. And I wonder how many other schools have taken on that same kind of learning facility.
Well, it's interesting because some of the big private independent schools have music as a very large part of the curriculum because there have been a lot of studies to suggest that if you're a musician, your IQ is about 7 to 10 points higher on average, you're a better critical thinker, you're a better decision maker, you're more motivated than people who don't play musical instruments because you have to sort of bring that element of literally daily, little and often practice and discipline into your life. That another subject other than perhaps sport wouldn't bring in.
Yeah, I can see that, yeah.
So yeah, and also as well, the frequencies music has on the brain also enhances it. This is a topic that I'm interested in, but not a massive expert in. But there has been some really interesting studies done by different universities. Now that we've got more sensitive electronic equipment, we can actually wire brains up and see what effect
Yes.
music has on the brain. So it's definitely beneficial, especially for anybody under 10. You start learning an instrument below the age of 10 and you rewire your neural pathway
There
to
was
listen.
a when I was at school when I was in primary school I was at a school called Hylies, which is in Peterborough. Our particular class was chosen to study violin, and there was eight people who were going to be taught violin, and I was so gutted that I wasn't one of these people who learned how to play. I was really personally upset that I wasn't chosen. I really wanted to do that, and I guess that's forever. It was always affected me, and I never got on to learn because I always thought that was my opportunity, and I didn't take it. But since
Did
then,
you not play an instrument at all?
no, not in school. I mean, I've actually since I've grown up, I've learned to play the flute actually. So, quite an interesting quirk that people don't know about me. I can play the flute.
Classical or
Actually,
folk?
a Native American, actually.
Native American, yeah, that's a
Yes.
bit. Because they're not quite tuned.
No, they're tuned very differently. Yeah, they're only 5 hole. But you know what really interests me? You mentioned about the physics and the harmonics. I mean, that's actually what drew me into learning about how a flute works. And you realize that it's not actually the blowing out the hole. Actually, it's a whole like convection of air. It's like, oh, that talks to me.
Also, how your cavities are as well.
Yes.
You can the different sort of ways that you open your throat and your jaw, you can affect the vibration of the flute as well.
Yes.
So it's all about sort of you, not just blowing down instrument
No,
itself.
it's a vibrato and oh, sounds
Yeah,
sounds.
really interesting. That's
It is.
another interview.
It's no, it certainly is, because I guess music plays such an important part, and sound around us is really important too. The sound waves that are coming into our body. But slightly rolling back, I guess to our topic of conversation about the state of surveillance. So when your child was in primary school and discovered this, the biometrics that being updated. So who maintains those databases of the children? Did you find that out through your investigation?
Basically, as I understand, each school has a standalone database. Varies depending on which company is supplying the database. Some of the biometric suppliers have access to the biometric data, some biometric suppliers don't. As far as I know, the government has never accessed any biometric data. It can. The police can also access school databases, biometric fingerprint data. I sent freedom of information requests to the police in 2013, every single police force, to see if they had ever access to school fingerprint database. Bearing in mind, we've been fingerprinting children in UK schools since 1999, so this is 14 years we've had these databases in schools. Well, the police must have accessed it at least once, because they have, even though the encryption will be different and the way the algorithm is created on a school database will be different from, say, IDENT1, which is the police national fingerprint database and DNA database.
Yes,
Yeah.
I've got your website up now regarding the police access to
Yeah, you can get
biometric databases.
interoperable programs that will talk. So, I mean, you've probably got the more accurate data there, but the vast majority of police forces that I ask simply refuse, citing an exemption under the Freedom of
Yeah, I
Information
see that there. That 80% of forces that replied to the Freedom of Information request stated they would it would exceed the appropriate cost limit for the force, which is 18 hours a week, £25 per hour, £450, citing Section 12 under the Freedom of Information Act. That does not oblige a public authority to comply with a request of information if the authority estimates the cost of applying would exceed the appropriate limit. Which is, isn't that the downside of freedom of information? Aren't they supposed to do this kind of thing?
actually rang the other statistics for some of the police forces that did answer or didn't know. I think it was one of the police forces that said, we don't know if we've accessed the school database. So I think I might have rung them up and said, how do you not know? Do you not have like a search facility for fingerprint or school? And they said, well, no, not really. How can the police force not have a database where you can't search it for, keywords like fingerprint school, transfer of data, I don't know, or communications they've had with schools? It was just bizarre.
I guess it would depend on who the database is kept by, and then is that we assume that it's going to be an online database where all that's happening, and we assume that
Yeah,
a
and
place would
again,
have
the thing
access
with
to it.
these databases, they different companies supply different police forces with different databases.
That's
They
right,
don't all
yes.
speak to each other,
No,
which is
the.
one of the reasons why I think was it the Bisham or after the Soho murders, where the two girls were murdered.
Yeah, so.
The police national computer was then set up, PNC was then set up, where it was just a text-based national police computer that was collating all the information from all these separate forces computers. So going back to the police accessing school databases, what we'll say is, because I didn't get an answer out of the police, what I did is, I think it was about 2 years ago, I did a report in conjunction with another privacy organisation, and I had freedom of information requests at sort of 230 schools, and one of the questions I asked them was, have you passed any biometric data onto government departments, i.e. security service, police, da da da. And a school in Liverpool, secondary school in Liverpool, came back and said, yeah, we've passed it on to the police and social services.
Ooh.
So I was like, oh, okay. So I got back to them and said, just be absolutely certain before I go to the press that this fingerprint's being transferred from schools to police databases. I didn't say I was going to go to the press, but they can I just clarify that what you're saying is you've given raw biometric data or encrypted biometric data to police and social services? And it took a while to get back to me, and they went, oh no, sorry, we made a mistake answering that question. I don't know. How do you make a mistake when you're obliged under law? Like, a freedom of information request response is going to be as robust as a response in a court of law. So if they're lying on the freedom of information, there's serious consequences for that,
Yeah, there is.
including making a mistake. But how can you make a mistake by saying you've told social services and police this information?
Because this guy, so I was kind of wondering, because I put down a couple of notes here regarding that, is that really? So if you were to, if information such as that transfers to, say, social services, like you said, so would it be potentially? Is it to gather a personality, behavioural, like actions, profile of each individual child? Because I'm not quite sure how it actually works. Because I'm assuming. It'll be a pattern of information of what they do. So, how often they went to the drinks machine, what did they have for lunch, when did they clock in and out of school, which I guess seems quite rudimentary. But suddenly, when you start creating a pattern together, you suddenly realise you are now watching this person's life, and you can sit there and look at that person doing what they do on a daily basis, which is like what Google do to us these days.
Well, social service wouldn't need a biometric identifier for that. And in actual fact, schools pass that sort of data on to other government departments anyway. So certainly, it's information about height, weight, school meals, attendance, reasons for not attending school is passed to health departments, pregnancies, whether people are excluded for social reasons, mental health issues. That what goes on in schools is certainly not kept absolutely within the confines of that school. It then goes to the Department of Education. Department of Education shares that with other departments.
So I kind of, the thing is, we kind of have a good idea of how, if you are receiving information, you when you when that's translated to giving a presentation or giving out information, it's broken down to a very simple format. So it might even simply be that they're just collating percentages of how many people are pregnant across the country or how many people are skipping school dinners, and we can go, okay, well that seems to make a little bit of sense, but that's the fundamentals of, wait a minute, you have a profile of my child that you've transferred between this, this, and this, and what are you doing with that?
This is the difference, okay? The all the if the schools were uploading information to the Department of Education, and some of the very personal details were anonymous, like pregnancy, how when you're ill and why you're ill, then you can sort of see aggregated information like that is good. And certainly there are what they call longitudinal studies done based on sort of the past 2, 3, 4 decades of education, learning, attendance, what people are now doing in so. So, for example, HMRC, the tax, Majesty's Revenue and Tax, are looking at sort of long past educational data with current educational data, knowing what the past was with the projection of tax income, and they'll do the same now and with it on the past models, project what's going to be coming in as income tax income for the next couple of decades, and also maybe identifying areas of vocations that may be oversubscribed or undersubscribed, so there'll be a push on maybe STEM projects in schools, which is science, technology, engineering, mathematics,
Yes.
or other things. So I think on an aggregate, as a country, I can understand why those sort of studies are being done. Like you said, and rightly said, is that this is not anonymised data. This is each record that goes up to DfE and out to whatever other government department. His name, date of birth, address, it's identifiable. So even though there is a vast amount of data on really every government database, HMRC, driving licence, passport, education, the processing power and capability of artificial intelligence now are coming to such a forefront
Yes.
that the quantity of data isn't particularly an issue anymore. It's what
No, because I'm assuming that there will be a time, whether that's even now, whether that's happening in the future, that this data will all be correlated to a personal profile of an individual. You can start. Well, so even for instance, now, if I log into Facebook and then I log into Skype as it asked me today, it's like, oh, do you want to sync your contacts? It's like, no. Because suddenly the database is coalesced and Microsoft has all the information from Microsoft as from Facebook and vice versa. And it seems like such an easy thing to do is press a button. But when you start syncing your information data together, you both of those companies then have a mirror of each other, and there's a forged profile of who you are, what you post about, who you talk to, how often you talk to them. In the same way that is your child, it's like, how often do they skip out of school? Now they've got a driving license. Where do they go online? What do? What do they look at? What do they see? Suddenly there's a very, very deeply personal profile of an individual that, could fit, personality types. And then you realize that is that are they tracking personality types for, future? I don't know. They might want to pick them up for MI5. They might want to. They'll specify a person already as, oh, that person's going to be a likely criminal. And when you start listening and talking, certainly to some of the people that we have done over time, is that there's the thought police, pre-crime systems that are coming into place. There's this Chinese-style Orwellian, state of surveillance program that's it's likely already to be starting here now, where you have a social credit system that's happening. So if you cross the road in the wrong place, you're getting marked down. Potentially, the effects of that could be that you might not be able to get a loan, you might not be able to get a car, you can't travel on public transport, and you suddenly realise that there's this whole restriction against you. And if your public profile is from birth, as opposed to being just that you've created recently, those databases start talking to each other, and there's a whole set of information that, if we say the government or a private institution can draw upon, that's really dangerous, I guess, insight into our personal life.
absolutely, I wouldn't disagree with one word of that at all. And you know, traditionally government databases haven't spoken to each other, now they do. So, for example, the Department of Education was passing children's date of birth and country of origin details onto the Home Office. So they were doing immigration sweeps on persons of, you know, children of interest and their families, and harvesting data like that. And of course, then we've got the PREVENT program, which is the government's anti-terrorist program that's been targeting all different sections of society, environmentalists, fundamental religious groups. But what's fundamentalist and what's the terrorist? You know, one person's terrorist, another person's freedom fighter.
It is, yeah, that can have many connotations either way, isn't it? So schools
have screening systems on all the platforms that they use, Google Classroom. You know, there's hundreds of virtual learning platforms that children use in schools, and you know, there'll be flash words that will flag up, you know, this user has just mentioned the word cliff and suicide, or this user's just mentioned the word knife, or you know, there's been children that have been pulled up for using innocuous words that, and this has gone on their educational record, but when it's been found to be completely innocent, that's not been taken off. They don't take stuff off.
It's just not why it's there.
It stays on there. So what do you do? I mean, do you sanitize everything? You start to become your own police.
Yes.
You don't need a policing system because we've got to start policing ourselves. And it's like this sort of thing at the moment with a Brexit. You know, if you've a voted Remain, everything's cool and, you know, sunny. But if you're a Brexiter, then suddenly, you know, you're a racist.
Or you're far right, yeah.
Brexit. I wonder how many people sort of admit that now, you know,
yeah.
Because you're suddenly this racist person. And same with sort of all the sort of blending of gender things as well.
Yes.
I mean, anybody can do what the hell they like.
Exactly.
But I'm going to say, I thought it was Jordan Peterson on this.
No, I agree with you on that. I was listening to him last night, actually. He was on the Joe Rogan show. So.
Yeah, he was. He was on live, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah.
Thousands of people watching.
Yes.
Quite interesting.
It is that the... and even now, to criticise that, of course, is now deemed illegal. Which is even
disturbing.
Twitter
accounts that are going down.
Any political conservative, or anyone who has an idea that is considered to be not part of the mainstream is now just debunked off, which it leads to a dissent where there's only one point of view. If you do not have this, you are, you know, ostracized in every kind of way. And then that's part of your public profile then, isn't it? When these databases start talking to each other, it's like, well, I can individually point that person out.
It's interesting because by throwing people like Alex Jones and whoever it was that was the Canadian journalist off Twitter recently, they just simply put them on another platform, or they simply don't go on digital at all. And they sort of lose track of the following of that person. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
If I was Google or Twitter, I would actually keep them on there and really squeeze that account so it had virtually no visibility at all. But I would want to keep an eye on that person. I want to know who my enemies are, you know. But, you know, they're throwing them off, which is fine. It's great.
I did see yesterday, my son told me that Putin's public Twitter profile has been frozen, which is quite interesting.
Really?
Yeah. Well, certainly, I think it's his English language one. I do
that
find it quite...
the impending Ukraine situation, do you
think? Yeah, it's not very... I don't know. I think we always have a very skewed view of what happens when you look at the press. So I haven't looked into what's happening or anything over there. So I find it very hard to judge and speculate on the situation. But
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sort of in my late 40s now, and I sort of now realise that I've just been lied to. Sort of by watching the news at 6 o'clock and 9 o'clock every night for the first sort of 30 years of my life, I sort of began to realise actually what I was seeing was one slither of the essence of truth. And now that we've got the sort of global internet in front of us, it's really interesting and useful to be able to get news from different sources.
Yeah, when we talk about say alternative media or even alternative facts, sometimes the facts are, well, I understand why a government would potentially want only one view, because of political, financial, economic reasons. I understand why a business wouldn't want the irreparable damage that they might receive. But, you know, if we're talking about transparency and truth, well, that's what we've got to have. Sorry.
That's it. And actually, sort of getting back to transparency and truth is one of the reasons why, I mean, sort of going back to biometrics, one of the reasons why we were really keen to get the technology out of schools was because No2ID was really instrumental in helping us. So about 15 years ago, the British government, the Labour government, tried to introduce biometric identification cards for all the adult population, and we weren't having any of it.
Yes.
So No2ID could see the fingerprinting of children in schools as a softening as the next generation, normalising this type of technology, this very personal technology, identifying technology. so that all the government would have to do in 20 years' time was reintroduce ID cards, and nobody worth an eyelid, because they'd been using their fingerprints to access school meals, knowledge, library books, you know, access to areas. So, and also as well, with this sort of surveillance they've got in school, you'll normalise the next generation to being surveilled. So the easiest thing then to sort of governments to do is, or corporations, whoever is to, who are now running the schools and, you know, certain big government departments, is to sort of monitor and sort of regain the narrative, because at the moment, what they were running the narrative through the television and the radio and the newspapers, which newspapers are still trying to do, but not very successfully.
No.
But I think what they're doing is coming full circle and coming round the other side of it and sort of trying to gain the narrative, sort of either through the education system or through us self-policing ourselves by not talking about things, because they're nudging us in certain directions. That's how I feel what's going on.
Yeah, I feel like that way too. There's a certain nudge to a certain narrative that we should adopt. It does feel a little uncomfortable when you start going, well, why are they doing this? And you realise that potentially the why is it to remain like the country we are? Is it because they're afraid of change themselves? Is that part of the, I hate to use the word agenda, is there some kind of a foreign policy or something dictating over the country, or even a corporation's lobbying just pushing these things through? I don't know. And I think it's we're certainly going through a very interesting time of transition in every kind of way as a culture, as a globalisation. And I think the internet really has been a catalyst of all this. It allows us to see, you know, a full spectrum of visibility of what's happening in every other country. If you wanted to, you can Skype anyone in the world from any country. You can talk to anybody with any kind of dissenting opinion. And I can understand why, unfortunately, in a room full of lots of people shouting, there might only be one person who's actually talking sense. Yeah. So I understand why you would only want perhaps certain voices to come through who are talking more logistically or more sensical than everyone, because everyone's got an opinion about absolutely everything. And social media, as wonderful as it can be to talk to lots of different people, unfortunately, it just becomes like a shouting box. And nothing ever happens. No one ever sees anything. You've been to groups as well as I have where there's 1,000 different opinions about the different ways it could go. And it's a mess and nothing ever moves forward at all. So
I also think as well that in some respects that does as good as spiritually, because what I've learned to do, because there is so many different opinions and so many different people from all walks of life, literally from all over the world, say, you know, get offering the opinion, you start to trust your gut instinct. And you start to maybe use those instincts that you haven't used for a while, because 20, 30 years ago, I was being told something, I just believed it, you know, sat and watched the news, read stuff in my books at school. But now I've got an alternative, and I have to start to. So it's interesting because the education I had was very fact-based, so I got given something, I had to memorise it because I couldn't access it anywhere else. I had to keep it in my head, because we didn't have computers through the 70s and 80s. So I memorised it, retained it particularly, and then I had to write it down, they tested me on it. But now the education has changed. I mean, when we were home educating, I wasn't short of any sort of information to give my kids. I mean, when we had the internet there.
Oh, so you homeschooled your children, was that right?
Yeah, we homeschooled them. It's from 11 to 16.
Okay, so how liberating was that?
Amazing. They were de-stressed. They got curious. They weren't confined by the blinkers that mainstream education puts on you. Like I say, we it was about, you know, we did the core maths, English, science subjects, but apart from that, we just got curious and we went to places, we did projects, my two boys were mad on Bear Grylls, so we'd watch Bear Grylls, and then we'd get the atlas out and work out where he was and what the atmosphere, you know, what the geographic climate was like and what politically it was like, and then we'd maybe go and download a recipe off the internet and try Guatemala and whatever it was.
That's a really interesting way to do it, yeah.
We sort of did stuff like that, so... But it's a question of teaching them how to discern information rather than trying to get them to retain information.
That's really a good distinction, that is, yeah.
Yeah. And so my eldest only got 5 GCSEs. He's now just finishing a degree at Russell Group University. He qualifies, he graduates next year. My youngest only got 4 GCSEs, and he's at Guildhall School of Music and Drama in London, which is... Pretty good.
Yes.
Somebody with only 4 GCSEs, but they both went to sixth form and jumped through the necessary boxes at A level. I mean, it was interesting. them going from being homeschooled back into mainstream education, and both of them were just like, they had this freedom to sort of do pretty much what they wanted within a certain boundaries, or learn what they wanted, which did them no harm whatsoever. And then they went into mainstream education, and suddenly they were like, this was a railway track.
There's you will you. Learn this There's way or else.
That's where we're going to go. And they were sort of a bit perplexed by it all, and I just said, you know what, just learn whatever you've got to learn. I mean, do learn, but just, this is about jumping through hoops now. Welcome to the real world, you know.
Yeah, so, you're going to pay that bill. So no,
just say, if anybody is thinking about homeschooling but has any doubts about it, it was the best thing we ever did. It was the best thing for the children, and I was lucky because I was able to, because I don't start work until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so I had that freedom during the day to spend.
So I guess you could still give them the school day of like 9 till 3, is it?
Yeah.
Did you structure it like that? Did you still kind of, we're going to study from after breakfast? Is that the plan? How did you do that?
Well, it's interesting because we knew a lot of other home educators, and nobody does it the same. Everybody does it differently. But nobody criticises anybody else because every child's different, which is what the school system doesn't really allow for. So because my children had been through primary school, they were used to a fairly structured day. So we would get up, and in the morning would be the maths, English, science, workbooks that we'd do. So basically after lunch, we would do art, go out, read books, do projects, cook, wash, garden. You know, and there was no homework involved. There was no.
I said, do you get homework at home to school? I'm thinking, no, you can't do it.
No, but they did after school clubs, and they did lots of musical activities and stuff at weekends. So they got out and saw. You know, we lived in the city, so. But I think the one thing that was good for them was just to see how normal life works. But it was interesting, the very first year we homeschooled was 2010, which was the year of the general election. And my eldest was 11 at the time, so he would have been in year 7. And at the end of every school year, we had a visit from the local authority, just to check we were doing the right thing.
Okay.
And which is their obligation, legal obligation to do so. And they were very good, actually, I have to say, where we were. They were very supportive. And so the guy comes and he says to my son, what's the most interesting thing that you've learned this year? So my son pops up and says, oh, I've learned all about the general election and hustings. And I just go, what? And this guy goes, what? And so my 11-year-old son starts to talk in depth about different types of political parties and different MPs that are running and different areas that have got different political beliefs. And I was absolutely gobsmacked. But what we'd done is, as we'd been home educating through the course of that year, I'd had either Radio 5 or a talk radio station or the local radio station on, which had been obviously talking about the general election.
Of course, yeah.
And he just mopped it up like a sponge. So this 11-year-old was more articulate about the general election than probably some adults were, which was great. So it was really interesting. And I thought that's actually a really good life lesson for him. He's probably learned more from that, but, you know, than I did when I was 11.
Yeah, because I guess even at school I never learned how to manage money, how to look after the life skills that I was going to need, and, like, you know, what's the process of how you get a car, what's the process of... You never taught, though. You just taught you must do these lessons here. And for a lot of people, they feel that the lessons aren't worth learning because they don't feel there's a connection to the topics of history and culture or geography, because they never feel that they're going to get anywhere. And I think even my son, actually, it does affect me a little bit that he was a bit... didn't quite fit in at school in that sense. He had a good education, I thought, but he was disruptive in the sense that he was always asking questions, always wanting to learn more. And he was always pigeonholed as a person who was therefore disruptive to the class and was told to go to the room outside and not be involved.
Well, isn't that giving him a message? Don't be curious. Don't ask any questions.
Yeah.
Why sit outside the group then? I mean, that's got a psychological message going on there.
Yeah, so I feel a bit disconcerting that perhaps he didn't get... But his interest is very much political. He's very much he's on the switch with what's happening across Europe, what's happening in groups online, the political... divide. He's very articulate between lots of different sects and understanding. But I'm like, sometimes I go, damn, you know more than I do.
Yeah, I mean, they this next generation, there's no excuse for ignorance now, but it's how you, and this is what I think is good about home education, it's how you use that information. Don't just retain it and regurgitate it like you get taught to do. You got to, there is a responsibility and obligation to to do something with that and make society a better place.
Yes.
Even if you're just a gardener and, you know, just... But there is no excuse now for anybody to be ignorant about anything, I don't think, unless you choose to be.
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it, man. I think, as anything, that's a life lesson, as a lesson encapsulated there. You, there's no reason not to be ignorant. If you are, well, why? Why are you choosing to shut yourself off? And then you think to yourself, well, is it? Are people shut themselves off because they don't want it? It's almost too much information. Certainly if you look at the internet, there's more information now than has ever existed in human history that is now at people's fingertips. And as such, they don't retain anything. They don't feel the need to because it's easily accessible. I mean, there was a whole thing about Plato wrote down that... Plato was actually upset about writing stuff wrote down because no one will remember anything. And when you also look at, say, even in the Victorian age, you look at their scribe and how they wrote in whole passages that had powerful meaning and lots of different connotations and ideas coming in. But now we can barely struggle to write a single paragraph or even a sentence.
That's Twitter, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We're down to the 240 characters now, and this is how you this is how you communicate your ideas in 240 characters and hope for the best.
But I think I heard, in fact, my son is in computer science at university, he was saying, or he sent me something that said, in the next 3 years, we're going to process as much data that we've processed in the past 5,000 or 6,000 years. We are at this point where we're just at this cusp where we're processing, even if all that data could be processed now, we're going to process more of it. And it's just, which is why, sort of getting back to the surveillance aspect, I don't know, I was talking to somebody earlier on actually, I put something recently on a Facebook page, which is quite boring, it only has stuff about biometrics and surveillance on and RFID, but there's a school in, is it Montessori School in the United States, and they are using CCTV, classroom CCTV, and RFID chips in slippers. So this is a classroom of 2 to 6 year old children. So they have to wear these little green slippers, both of which have identifying tags in, which are, I don't know if they're emitting radiation or they're passive and the scanners are picking them up, I don't know. But they're tracking the children around the classroom, who they're hanging out with, if they're spending a lot of time on the Lego, and then suddenly what are they doing with the Lego, the camera's there observing them. And if you go on the article, one of the funders of this is the Zuckerberg Foundation, so this is Facebook. In education, or starting to get into education, I'm sure they're already in education anyway, and certainly Google are, but they openly admit that there's so much data that they're getting from these children, facial expressions, bodily gestures, the way they move, how they're interacting with the toys, and why they're interacting with them, that they don't actually know what to do with it. They don't know what to do with
it. Well, that's always quizzed me as well, big data. I mean, who does it benefit in what way?
Well,
right now,
they're using all this data to teach AI. So at the moment, it's like nurturing a small baby. And that's what they're doing. They're gathering as much data to see what they can do with it and what they can't do with it, what's useful, what's not useful, what's salient. And then when they've... it's not so much about the data, it's about asking the right questions. What do you want from the data? And who wants that information from the data? Because it's commercial, you know.
You can always say AI. So, say you have a pattern of a child, what they do in their classroom and where they go. I understand the pattern would potentially be, if we were to mimic and create a robotic child or a cybernetic child, what kind of behaviours would they have to exhibit in a classroom so they would fit in? How would they learn? But the computer might already say, well, I already know what they're going to do with it. I already know how to build Lego. So actually, I might just try to interact with this child in a way that perhaps makes them feel comfortable. So I will reflect and mimic them. I'll move my hair or touch my nose to make the person they're talking to, you know, reflective and responsive. And would it be maybe that you could have a pattern of what you want to enforce? Is that you will go through the, you will have to, everyone in the classroom has to leave at 9:50, and you all have to have passed over the line of the door by 9:55 to get to the next classroom, because everything's in a hurried, productive state. You know what it's like at work. You know where you have to. It's all about the so they measure productivity. So if they monitor every single step that you make, like you said, there's in every shoe, they know exactly where you are at all the times. Are you moving fast enough? Are you slagging behind? Are you choosing to go talk to your mates by the locker? Or are you getting hurried to get to learn again? And it sounds almost like very like Chinese Orwellian style directorate control. Very, very... The vision is quite, is almost there, isn't it?
I can say, I don't think they know what the purpose... What purpose the data can be put to yet. There'll be somebody somewhere with a purpose for that. If This is why, you know, we campaigned against using your biometrics in schools, because that is an absolute identifier for you. I mean, the systems aren't perfect at the moment because they're
Everyone's
not
still individual.
biometrically identifying people, so there's still room for error. Pardon me. And I can see, you know, if these government databases, in order to be more accurate, they would have to capture everybody's biometrics. And there's no doubt that Bill Smith on this record is that Bill Smith over there, and it's not another one, or it's not William Smith who's over there, because you've got a matching fingerprint. And I don't think, as a society, we're mature. Maybe I'm being too up my own backside with this, but I don't think we're mature enough to handle that sort of information. If you look at data gathering in the past, certainly IBM were involved with Second World War.
Of course, yeah.
The reasons behind, I mean, data is data. It's like a hammer. You know, you can build a house with it, or you can cleave somebody's head in.
Yes.
Data is simply just data. It's the way that you use it that matters. And the less data you give up, the more opportunity we have to be mature with it, but the less opportunities for you to be manipulated by it. That the more you keep your digital footprint clean or less digital as possible, I think in the long term, in the next few decades, that's prudent. Because there could be predictive algorithms, like predictive policing. So Kent Police have been using something called Predpol for the past 5 years.
What was that?
Predpol, predictive policing, is... I did some research on this a while ago, but from what I remember, it's sort of using Google Maps to predict where areas of crime might be based on where areas of crime have been in the past, due to weather, time of day, time of year, where sort of based on past statistics where hotspot crime areas might be. So they've been running this for about 5 years, but last week they quietly dropped it because it wasn't very good. but that was a nice opportunity for Google to know what algorithms not to use. And this is what they were doing in schools with biometrics, and it's actually what they're doing at the moment with... we have a lot of educational technical companies in the British schools market at the moment, emerging startups over the past sort of even 3 years. I would estimate that the market's at least doubled in size with the amount of companies banging on the schools' doors to get in there to get data from the kids about how they read. So, for example, just put it on a plain level, if you've got a maths or an English or a geography app that you're doing your homework on, or even just doing in school, it will time how long it takes you to do questions. So it might deduce that you're better at multiplication than you are subtraction. So what it'll do, it will give you some subtraction homework to do more than multiplication, because this particular user isn't, you know, doing as well on that. Or how long it takes you to read a book. You know, if you're a slow reader, you're turning the pages, the e-pages very slowly, and there might be bits of the book that's very good. So the computer thinks, oh, well, that certain element is appealing to this certain class of pupils. But so the problem they had with that in the States, which is where the EdTech sort of business grew up, was that it's okay when you're in school because the teacher can see that little Johnny's using that computer and logged in as little Johnny. But when little Johnny goes home and does his homework, his mum and dad might do it for him, or his best mate might do it for him, or his older brother might do his math homework for him. So they're not getting realistic data on how little Johnny's doing. That anomalous data goes in the system and then, you know, forecasts are skewed. So what they tried to do in San Francisco was the school district got given a load of iPads from this tech company saying, we'll give you the iPads, we'll give you the program for free. but what we're going to do is we're going to facially scan every child every 60 seconds to check its MSAT in front of it. So this is where the biometric identification is going, is to verify the user.
Because I guess it's
going in the system, basically.
Yeah, because when you think about how now, like, mobile phones are, that you can open up with your biometric thumb, or with the new iPhone X, it looks at you, or within a tenth of a second, it can recognise who you are, and obviously you'll open the phone up for you. I think actually that's more worrying to have how easy that is to be you, you know? And if someone else can mimic you, or just have your data that's recognised, it could very easily be corruptible, be hacked, or just, someone will insert information into there. How easy is that done?
Well, if you think about it, I mean, if I've got a password in my head, the only person that knows that is me. I'm leaving my fingerprints and face all over the place. You know, I'm touching everything every day. My face is being captured on CCTV, or somebody takes a photograph of it, or I'm stupid enough to put it on social media. Like, oh, now. But do you know what I mean? That And there's been instances of the police, the police said to me, I've got your phone, give me your password. And I went, no. They'd be like, oh, okay. But now they just go, doink. And it's open. They've got access to your phone. And
Of
then
course.
I think there was an instance where that had been reported maybe about 2 months ago. And I've, put it on Twitter and went, oh, what a surprise. Who would have thought?
Because it's so easily done now. It's like because everyone wants it to be easy as possible. And I do think potentially, we're looking at like surveillance and information, how things can open up. I mean, I guess potentially down the line, we're talking about future projects. I mean, I guess you would perhaps have some kind of cybernetic implant, such as the something in your hand or something in your head. So you can't get into work unless you swipe on this machine with your handprint, and it also picks up you not only the handprints of who you are, but the RFID, and it will detect you at some place. Workplaces are now requesting that you are, and it's like how far will this? Because they say it's all in the name of security, but it's like whose security? It's not ours.
No, it's all in the name of data and surveillance, and I think there's a certain element of the narrative being lost. I think the narrative was able to be set a few decades ago, and now because of the amount of freedom, the amount of information that's out there, and the way that people can express themselves, I think there's a narrative that's being lost by the people that want to control it. So surveillance. Tells them who's talking about what and who's maybe driving what narrative. I mean, for example, whether you like him or hate him, Alex Jones
Yeah.
has taken off social media. And I find that very worrying. I mean, I've listened to Alex, 15, 20 years ago, he was the only lone voice out there.
It's true.
And I respected that about him. I don't particularly agree with everything he's done
No,
and the direction that he's gone in, but he was the first to be taken down. And actually, that was a shot across the bow, really. I mean, I've made backups for my website. It's not that, I'm any big fish in the sea, but I just in case, you don't know. I mean, there was just recently there was a whole load of sites that got taken down,
Yeah, that's right.
or dumped off Google search engines so you couldn't find them. So I don't
It's
know.
worrying
Like you
because
say, we are in interesting times. It's
they're
really
very interesting times. I mean,
kind
I
of.
think I still wonder what the potential, what is the archetype vision that they have for everyone to be running and living under? And it's something like when you start talking about security and surveillance and monitoring of each and every moment, it suddenly becomes in that we're no longer going to be people anymore. We're going to be very much dictated by productivity and how much work you're putting in, how fast you're walking, where you are at certain times in your house. Like we've all seen 1984, where there's the telly screen in the house that monitors how much activity, exercise you have to do.
Do you know what? That's interesting you should say that, because on today on the radio, I don't know if you caught it, there was a big sort of report that came out saying that they can reverse diabetes too. And by doing that, you've got to intake 800 calories a day, or between 810 and 850 calories a day. And they're going to do it by juicing and liquid diet and everything. And the NHS is going to roll this out for free
All right.
for loads and loads of people. You're going to get a special consultant, and they're going to give you a Fitbit. So they can monitor you. So yeah, you're just what you were talking about. They're going to be so. I mean, that Fitbit isn't for the patients'
No.
information. That's for the NHS's information, or whatever company is running that particular
Well,
scheme.
it's free for a reason. I think I've certainly learned to discover that if it's free, it's because you're the customer.
That's right. Because it's not, it's free because you're giving them something. They're taking something from you. It's not free for you. It's like Sainsbury's or Tesco's or any sort of reward card, which I don't have. They're not giving you anything. You're giving them far more than they're giving you. It's not a fair exchange. So
No, it's
yeah.
like
So I, but you're right. And also as well, if you've got a Fitbit, hey, goodness, your health insurance might come down because or you might be more capable of getting a longer mortgage because you're fitter than somebody who hasn't got a Fitbit and tracker. It's
well,
like
yeah, because it's like, well, can you survive 25 years? Well, we're not quite sure. So that mortgage is going to be at a higher premium, so we can get more money out of you in the meantime.
that's right. It's like putting the black box in cars of people, young insurance car insurance drivers.
Yes.
You get cheaper insurance if you've got the black box. Well, if you've got that Fitbit on you.
Is it not the same thing? Well, you can imagine when the databases start talking to each other, there's a whole distinct
Well, I'm not even
individual.
sure whether Fitbit has a GPS tracker in. So, I mean, certainly it can monitor your heart rate, the amount of steps you do, the amount of sleep you have, that sort of thing. But I because I haven't got a Fitbit, I don't know. I mean, but if it has a GPS tracker in, that would be interesting as well, because suddenly you've got a government department that's tracking the
Everything you
attention
do,
you're paying
everything you
on your
say, everywhere
Fitbit.
you go. If it's got a
So,
mic on it, who knows what comes next?
yeah. But I mean, that's
Mean, we're speculating there, but yeah, it suddenly becomes, it goes very quickly from science fiction to science fact, that the blur line is right there. And I've always thought when I listen to like dystopian dramas or whatever, they're not warning about, this is going to come. It's a case of do what you can to avoid this from happening.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to note that the big tech company bosses are not letting their children anywhere near screens or high
Yeah.
tech stuff.
I
I know
think
schools that
the
don't
fact.
have.
Yeah, the very first time I ever heard anyone like that, apparently I heard that Steve Jobs never let any of his children have an iPad or an iPhone. And then Bill Gates never let his children have a phone. And it's like, why is that? I don't know. I learned that 15 years ago. But it is one of those things. Why would you not let them have this information? And they know because they are the forefront driver of the vision of what the product will be.
The screen time has a number of different effects. I mean, sort of just primarily the type of light on a screen is at such a high frequency that if you're using it late at night, it's essentially telling your brain that it's still daylight. So if
Yes.
you've got a night mode on any sort of screen that you use, I would advise using it because it
Yes.
takes the terahertz, the frequency of light, right down to sort of a low mode. So it's telling your brain it's dusk, it's night time, you need to go to sleep. So apart from anything else, that's why we have a lot of problems, I think, with especially children in schools or people not sleeping properly is because they're doing screen time late and their brain thinks it's still daylight.
Yeah, right. I have my phone brightness down like maybe 1 or 2% because I suffer with light sensitivity, so I keep that
Yeah,
really.
it's really interesting, but it has some sort of profound effects on the brain, but also as well, have screen time as young as children, sort of as 13 months old, who can start to understand what screens are. It sort of shuts down bits of the brain. Again, I'm not a big expert on this, but there was a very interesting article in the New York Post, I think, only about 2 years ago, about how addictive screens were for young children. And there was a big program about trying to get people screens, but actually, to de-screen a child completely is impossible.
Isn't
Because
that?
every time you go shopping or you're,
Everything's on a screen.
everything, the information's there on screens
You know
and
what really bugs me? Everything has an app. Everything and everyone, every company, everything wants its own app, and everything wants to source its own data. I guess to assume, to sell it or to do whatever they want to do with it. But it's like, come on, I don't want to. I don't want another app. I'll just happily use the browser. Just let me be the controller of it.
I mean, it's interesting because my youngest son is not on social media at all. He used to be on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. He's taken himself off everything. Now he's sort of a musician and will benefit from having a high social media profile, but he chooses not to. And in some respects, that's almost like a sort of a unique selling point for him because if somebody wants to know if he's good, they've got to go and watch him, which is, and getting that somebody in front of you to
Yeah.
watch you is really difficult because people can just do it on social media and watch video. So I don't know whether he's done it as a savvy move, but actually he did sort of say to me, even when he was sort of 16, 17, I'm spending so much time looking at rubbish. I was like, well, don't, So he'd made the decision and turned it all off, which, good for him. I have really big respect because he can't be profiled now, or a lot less chance of being profiled and sold out than a lot of people his own age. I mean, he's 20 now.
Yeah, I think the way that people use social media is different as well. People use it for different reasons. So I saw a study about the amount of levels of dopamine that people get every time they post, as they scroll up Facebook or Twitter. Your body actually produces a dopamine hit every time it goes sees new information. So people literally are scrolling, and what it actually is it's tricking your brain into getting a drug. It feels good to keep scrolling to find new information. Really disturbing, actually, because I guess that's what keeps you scrolling. And sometimes I've been guilty of it myself. 20 minutes later, and I'm still scrolling. What's going on? And you have to consciously go, no.
Do you know what? Yeah, me too. Me too. I just sort of have to pick myself up and think, what are you doing? You've just spent, 20 minutes of your life that you're never going to get back again, gazing at a screen and got nothing from it at
No,
all. It's crazy.
it's so simple and easy to do that. But when we're talking about children, there. I mean, I was at work the other day. And I saw a child with it's like a kids' magazine, CBeebies magazine on his lap, and he was trying to swipe the pages.
No.
Yeah, no, I'd heard about that people there, but to actually witness it was really the child had no concept of differential that he had to turn the page. He literally was trying to swipe the page to see the next thing. And on his lap, it was only about 2 years old, and that was quite perplexing to see a child struggle to turn a page. And I was like, what are we living in right now?
Because I mean, thankfully, I didn't have that sort of decision to make the screen because it was just a television. I mean, I don't have a television now, but 20 years ago it was Thomas the Tank Engine on the video.
Yeah.
There was another sort of screen stuff, and
So you say you have no,
really.
so you say you have no screens in your house. I mean, I have often said that, but I do realize I do actually have
Well,
a
I've got.
screen.
I actually have a TV there. I don't
Yeah.
know if you can sort of see.
Yeah.
I sort of it just completely, we plug it into Netflix and
Same
sort of
here.
that. But yeah, so we don't. Yeah, so we have a TV, but I don't watch mainstream.
Yeah, so I was plugged into like Netflix and Amazon Prime and stuff, and I use the PlayStation for it because it has all those apps via that that piece of hardware. But that's it. I don't have not connected to the house whatsoever. And it's interesting that on that very note, I was trying to lower my bill with Virgin Media, who's my internet provider, because I physically do not use the television box in any way, shape, or form. And they're like, "Yeah, but you have to have it as part of the package." And I'm like, "No, I cannot legally use it because I don't subscribe to the BBC. You know, I don't pay my license fee. Therefore, I cannot use this product." And they're like, "Well, actually, for us to take it away from you, it actually would increase your bill by £3." And I'm like, "What?" So it's like close to £50 just for the broadband and the television and the telephone. But actually, if you take one of those services away, it increases the price because they say we're not providing you with a service or any. And I was like,
You know what?
really?
What they're not getting is data. And even though you're not using the service, that's data for them. They know that they've got a box there that somebody's not using, so a percentage of people with boxes don't use them, da 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 da. But
Yeah.
if you give that box back, they won't know that.
No.
So
Because I
yeah.
guess they are tracking like what channels you watch, when you watch them. So I guess it provides it with a Nielsen data, doesn't it? You know, how many people are watching like Doctor Who or whatever, how many people are watching like Strictly Come Dancing. And if they're not getting that data in there, you know, that skews those views. And you know, someone might be watching an illegal stream or whatever it is that they do. So the data is skewed. And I guess that's what the information is for. But I don't subscribe to watching television at all anymore. I just don't need or want to.
It's interesting because there's so much data that we leave just in one day in a data foot in digital footprint. I mean, I haven't done the exercise myself, but it would be interesting just to spend one day and try not to leave a digital footprint on, like not use my phone, not put the computer on, not watch the telly, try not to stand in front of a CCTV camera, maybe not to go on a bus where there's CCTV. It must be it's so difficult. And all that data is there. And at the moment, it's pretty useless because the technology is, even though we've got some amazing technological advances, you know, in comparison to even 5 or 10 years' time, this will be immature. But it's where that data goes and how it's going to be used in the future. I mean, at the moment, I'm looking at a company who is thinking it's a good idea to put a fisheye camera, a 360-degree camera, in classrooms in schools to monitor, well, they say it's for teacher development, but actually, what they're doing is that they're looking at behaviour. And how they teach, how the children behave. It's like a psychological tool almost. But this has never been done. So traditionally, there's been no CCTV cameras in classrooms because it's a sort of a sacred space. They put them in corridors and sort of around the perimeter of schools and stuff like that, but never in classrooms. It's been a no-no. But now this company's done it without any okay from the Department of Education. We don't know if the Information Commissioner's office has been involved. So I've just sent a load of Freedom of Information requests to the 4 schools and the Department of Education about this because the schools are saying the only person who has access to it is the teacher, so they can see and improve their teaching methods. You know, I'm a teacher myself, and I can understand that being able to view yourself might be quite beneficial. But actually, what's the trade-off? You've televised, you've recorded audio and visuals. It's not
And
the same.
people behave very differently when they know they're being recorded.
Well, this is it. Interestingly enough, in this company's brochure, it says, after a while, the children don't know. Forget they're being recorded, and everybody acts as normal. It's like, yeah, it's Big Brother house.
Well, yeah, that's it. It's the Big Brother house, isn't it? You know, everything being monitored, everyone every time.
So there's a great website called What Do They Know? So anybody who's wants to ask for information requests, or anybody that has, I think it's over 500,000 requests. No, I think it's over 200,000 requests on there, and they get about 500,000 hits a month.
So
Just
what do they know
search
dot com,
the
okay.
box. And you can type in, if you wanted to see my Freedom Information request, you could type in Pippa King, and I think about 140 of them on there. So the last four are to these particular schools running this audio and visual. And then it sort of says in the brochure as well, you know, because the audio, we've got studio quality audio microphones in there, which is great. But actually, on one-to-one, quiet one-to-one conversations, we can't record. So I tell you what, we'll give the teacher a lapel microphone. Like,
What?
oh
Wow, that's incredible. So the police are
no.
so intending to use.
And I'm not convinced that the children or parents are fully aware of what's going on because not one parent has objected. Now, I would object if my child was being filmed in schools for many reasons. Apart from privacy, I think there's a psychological effect to A, being filmed, and then B, forgetting you're being filmed. You know, I think
Yeah,
that's.
if the teacher's sat there with a mic on them as well. Yeah, I've come across your page on What Do They Know Here, and that's been shown at the moment. So yeah, there's 145 requests been made. So I'm looking at some here like biometric facial recognition, analytical technology, police national database, facial recognition capability. Yeah, that they are powerful delivery services of information, aren't they? So there's police national database, facial recognition, biometric search data, and PIA services. I guess also the difficulty might be is if they change the language of what the it's called. So I did read I'm sure I read it is that if unless you know what the document is that you're looking for, they're not obliged to tell you where if they've got any information upon it.
You have to be careful what you ask for, because if it's a bit too general, they'll
Yeah,
say, you
it's too
know.
vague. I know I'd understand why they would do that.
Yeah, this is why if you do go on What Do They Know and go to one of my freedom information requests, I always put at the bottom, if you're unclear of what I'm asking, please
Please.
hesitate to get back in touch with me. Or if you are unable to answer the request because of cost, let me know the bits that you can answer and I'll reduce the request. Or, what's the other one that I put on there? There's three little points anyway, just so there's no get out clause, because most government departments will wait 20 working days, which is their sort
Yeah.
of remit under the legislation to answer you, and then quite often they'll go over that, so in the hope that somebody might respond within 20 working days. But only also, yeah, so there's, I forget what the other one is, but it's a really useful website. You
Yeah, I
can.
could see that it is, yeah.
Yeah,
I actually
see.
might spend some time on here myself.
Yeah. So, for example, and the facial recognition was quite. And I'm still quite involved with facial recognition use, the police use of it, and also, well, public space use of it. I think if somebody chooses to go to a gym where they have a facial recognition door system, fair enough. That's your choice. Brilliant. I would choose not to, but I'm not going to tell people what to do. But it bothers me when that sort of technology is being used in a public space by the police, by shopping centres, by, I don't know.
Is
So
it to send you more vouchers to know
exploiting
how often you
prostitutes.
come?
Yeah, so I can consent. I can choose whether or not to access a gym or a facility with my face. I choose not to. But I don't choose to go to, say, the Cenotaph Memorial Service last November, where the police were using facial recognition. They were using facial recognition to pick up on people that might be potential threats. People that had no criminal records, but just people that were persons of interest to them, that might have been sort of on their fixated threat database, which they run in conjunction, that police run in conjunction with the NHS. So there's that they have a list of what they would perceive as perhaps mentally obsessed people that have never committed a crime, that possibly on social media have been a bit obsessed about a particular personality or a member of the royal family, or and they sort of get flagged up and get put on this database. So the police were at the memorial service last November scanning crowds to check if any of these people were there to potentially hurt somebody. Now, the threat of that, the use of that technology is completely unproportionate, because I can never ever remember anybody ever being attacked at a Cenotaph Memorial Service. Can you?
No, I really can't. No, I guess is it the potential that it might happen, and that's what they need
It
to do.
might, but it never has. So, but is that a justification to bring in facially scanning crowds for persons of interest?
I mean, that's
Because if
not,
the
I was in.
temptation then is to put in other persons of interest, that I wonder what, I wonder, you know.
Well, yeah, you suddenly start tracking everybody else, and then everyone else becomes like police profile, isn't it? You set in a database of well, they were at this venue at this time. They form. Might also flag upon another database. They come together and it's like, oh, this person could be a person of interest. I mean, oddly enough, I was in the city centre of Nottingham yesterday, and the entire Market Square is on a police lockdown. You get armed police walking around, like with assault rifles on their chest. There's a what's been dubbed by social media as diversity bollards, massive concrete blocks that look like they got presents painted over the top of them. And they're everywhere in the Market Square, and you can, I don't know if there's any facial recognition technology being implemented there, but they must. It can't be cheap. I mean, I was told. Actually, my son came for me some information. It says it was more than £500,000 of security information that has been put in for Christmas here. The city shopping centres have got anti-ramming bollards been added in front of them, and there's new cameras that have been implemented. And you can see them here, and it's like, damn. So is that now captures everybody and everyone? Is that, and we're talking about how things that shouldn't change our way of life, and suddenly actually that becomes a necessity. to our way of life, that we have to have this to protect us or to keep us safe or from whatever potential threat that might be.
I don't know, it's interesting because as a nation, we this is sort of this urban myth that we've got sort of a fifth or a quarter of the world's CCTV cameras. And I think there's a certain element of truth behind that. We certainly have got the vast majority per person of CCTV cameras. And maybe it is a quarter or a fifth, but if you go to noccctv.co.uk, which is a group that's been around for about 20 years opposing CCTV, great bunch of people. Just looking at statistics, whether or not it has solved crime or whether it prevents crime, and our crime statistics are no different from any other country's crime statistics because of CCTV. So, but once they've gone up, they're not going to come down. And I think the thing that worries me about that sort of technology is that we've got all the cameras up there, but essentially what's running behind them is different technology now. So our street furniture doesn't change. If you look at a camera, you can't be certain what analytical systems are being run behind that. So for example, in Glasgow, they have something called Suspect Search that's running, that is set up behind 70 of the public space cameras in Glasgow.
Okay.
This is supplied by a company called NICE, Nice Systems, from Israel, which is a securities company. And so they've had this system behind the public space CCTV cameras in Glasgow for 3 years now, but not switched it on. So this system is capable of person tracking. So the operators in this big control room can say, okay, so we've got a person of interest who's wearing...
So we click this guy on what it's...
Red coat and blue shoes. We want to find all the people with red coat and blue shoes. Oh, it's him, let's track this one. Or it can identify, there's a gathering of people here. There's an anomalous, sort of gamut. So they can send police there. If there's a demonstration in Glasgow, they can use the cameras to predict where the crowds would go. They can identify, a bit like Predpol, Kent police. Predictive policing, so they can sort of say, oh well, this area is particularly dark and there's a person there that's loitering, so beep 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 beep, this comes up as a little alert on the screen, so they've got this sort of smart analytics behind it. But so I've been sending Glasgow City Council Freedom of Information requests now, I think for the past 4 years, twice a year.
Yes.
They've had it installed, but they can't sign up for privacy impact assessment. So any sort of surveillance that gathers data on other people, especially members of the public, by the under law and the Data Protection Act, you have to carry out a privacy impact assessment. So actually, if you go to my What Do They Know, you'll see one of the recent ones is me going back to the Glasgow City Council and saying, have you switched it on yet? They've had it up from, I mean, God knows how much they paid for it.
Yeah, because
they're ready to flip the switch, but they just can't make it fit into our privacy legislation, which is good because there's no other system running like this, certainly in Europe.
That can't be cheap in any way, shape or form.
No, but they have it running in places, I believe, like sort of in the Middle East, where I think what the privacy laws are very different to the privacy laws of
Relax, I guess.
But it will be interesting. I don't know if anybody else is watching the Glasgow predictive smart city CCTV that they've got there, which is actually not CCTV, it's not closed circuit, it's IP. So it is that Chinese credit system is already set up, ready to go, really, in Glasgow. It's just a question of
being enabled. Actually, I'm curious to go and tap my own council up and go, you guys got a lot of cameras about.
Well, interestingly enough, the police that are using facial recognition technology are Leicester, Met Police, South Wales Police. Gwent Police have got a facility to use it, but they haven't done yet. So this is live in the field, sort of, real-time facial technology, and they use it sort of on top of police vans, so it's a mobile unit. The Glasgow one isn't potentially, it's called facial detection rather than facial recognition. So facial recognition says this is a picture of John Smith and we want you to find the John Smith in the crowd, whereas there's no backup database for the Glasgow one. The Glasgow one is just saying, oh, we want to find people that look like this with glasses or, you know. But there is a potential to have a source database for them to reference through the cameras to find in the crowd. So what I was going to say was, but there are two police forces that are looking at putting that particular facial recognition or detection software behind city cameras, and that's actually three. pardon me, one is Grimsby Town Council and Grimsby Humberside Police. The other one is Essex Police, Brighton and Hove Council, looking to put some sort of facial recognition behind their static public CCTV. And the other one is Kirklees, the authority of Kirklees, Leeds Metropolitan Council, Bradford, Wakefield. So basically, it's the police jurisdiction that covers that area. So it's, again, it's been a while since I looked at it, but they were looking to put the facial detection recognition. But if you've got the, so basically, any system that's detecting a face is just saying, this is a cluster of pixels that looks like a face. We want you to pick out this cluster of pixels that looks like this cluster of pixels.
Yeah, because the resolution on these cameras is not great. I mean, where I work, of
it's
course.
It's not great, but it's a lot better than it was. And it's,
certainly,
so really,
is.
The only sort of criteria you need for an accurate facial detection is about 20 pixels between the two eyes. That's the sort of, which isn't an awful lot. So, and there was a recent report by Cardiff University, I think it only came out a couple of days ago, on South Wales' police's use of facial recognition, and I think the live scenario was about 64% because of the definition of the photographs. In a static scenario, so you can either have facial recognition on people moving around in a live scenario, and then it'll go beep beep beep, here's what we think is so and so, then officer will go and intervene. When I was actually with the Met Police at Notting Hill Carnival a year and a half ago, with the Met Police in their little booth, sort of watching how the same facial recognition system is working. So, but they also have it on a static. So what they do, they'll take a photograph from CCTV and then have a police custodial photograph database, and then they'll run a static image against another static image, basically. So you've got live where you've got static to moving, static. Static's a lot. They have a percentage rate of in the 70s, so it's about 10-15% more accurate.
Yeah.
Which is live. So South Wales Police have been running this pilot for about 18 months in Cardiff University. They just wrote a report on it and sort of had said this. So rather than just switch off and say, okay, well, it's sort of accurate, it's helped. I think we've had 18 more arrests than we would have had normally over that period of time. So again, the question is, has the jump in people arrested, is that a good trade-off for the level of privacy that you've invaded on a load of people? Even though those people aren't aware of it. But I think the thing is as well that the company, which is NEC, NEC, Nippon Electronic Company in Japan, that supply the Met Police, South Wales Police, and also Leicestershire Police with the facial recognition technology, I got told not to say this, but I'm going to say it, this is 18 months ago. We got told when we went to Notting Hill Carnival, I was with Big Brother Watch, Liberty, that basically NEC were testing an algorithm out. The Notting Hill Carnival is a predominantly dark-skinned carnival. It's a South Caribbean carnival. One of the ways that facial recognition, one of the areas facial recognition doesn't work very well in is on dark-skinned people because
of the
contrast of the light and dark on the pixels of the faces that pick up isn't very good. It's not as good as the lighter-skinned person. So essentially, they were testing that section of the population to try and improve their algorithms to see whether they could improve their success rate, basically. I wasn't told that, but that's the assumption.
Yeah, I guess that's a summarization, isn't it? Because I'd read something very similar, like there was a dark-skinned individual who was complaining and wanted to take a company who made hand dryers to court because it doesn't detect when he puts his hand underneath when he goes to use a dryer in a public toilet. Because it can, obviously it's the light that bounces off the skin that activates it, and because it's a black skinned individual, it doesn't work. So I guess there's little things that I guess if you are a dark skinned individual, it's not very good for. But I guess when it comes to cameras, though, you know, I guess they actually, they say they want to arrest more people or they want to capture them because they potentially, I guess the stereotype is commit more crime, as is the perception by some.
The intent behind the use now, we get told one thing, but I think there's another intent, but certainly even a year, two, three, 5 years down the line, the intent will be completely different.
Yeah. So I guess as the technology evolves and matures and people's intent changes, and I guess the criteria of why they've got it in place, and then well, we've got it here, we'll use it also for this and this. Like we're talking about static cameras being therefore used now to, well, we can now network them, we can now use this instead. The technology has matured through its evolution. So I guess, like you said there, in 15 to 20 years' time, the definition of why it's there and what its purposes will change.
But this is why I'm asking questions of the four schools that are using CCTV in classrooms, or the IPTV, this constantly 24/7 switched on audio and visual system, because at the moment the teachers and the schools are saying, where you're just purely using it for teacher development purposes. But actually, if you start to read some of the articles, the blog of the company that's supplying the equipment, they're identifying different behaviours in students. They're using it for restorative justice. Things like, say for example, there was one teacher in one of the schools that was using the system, noticed that a boy was engaging with the class, engaging with her teaching when she looked at him. When she wasn't looking at him, he was distracted. That was me at school, you know what I mean? So yeah. So she decided that she would, you know, engage with this student. So she went and sat and had lunch with him on a regular basis and started asking him about what he did out of school, what motivated him. And I was like, hold on a minute. Those cameras weren't to be for your teaching development. Now you're actually sitting and essentially sitting with this boy. I mean, on a social impact, what are his friends going to think? What is, you know, is he suddenly now going to be a teacher's pet? And should he be giving her, you know, what's going on in his private life? What motivates him? Like, these are personal things to him, but because these children in a compliant situation, they don't know any different.
No.
So let's look at that in a different way. Okay, so you've got another teacher and another student. You've got a 23-year-old male teacher who's just qualified, sports teacher maybe, and you've got a 15, 16-year-old girl that he thinks is this interesting. Suddenly, what was good for that female teacher and that 11-year-old boy
is that not by definition.
It's a bit different. You know, if this 23-year-old starts having lunch, you know, five times a month with the same girl, but even if it's absolutely innocent, the amount of stick she's going to get on social media and from
perception,
her friends,
yeah,
is unbelievable. So actually, the intent and purpose of that camera now is not just for teacher development, it's not for student development. And I know it's generally for student development, but not on that sort of level. And on another note, in one of the colleges that I've, one of the academies that I've, Freedom of Information Request, they're using it for restorative justice. So
what do you mean by restorative justice? Because I'm a bit confused by that.
Restorative justice is where the victim and the bullier sit down together and, you know, sort of talk about what's happened. So I was talking to somebody who's doing some work in this field, sort of teacher development, and she was sort of saying to me, on a psychological level, if you play video back of somebody being bullied to the person who was being bullied and the bullier, that could have actually quite a damaging psychological effect on the person who's being bullied to actually live through the experience again, but just to watch himself be bullied. Nobody really knows, or I don't know, I mean, it's not my subject area, sort of what effect that can have, just sort of visually going through it again, but from a camera point of view,
yeah,
knowing that other people can see that. And also, while bullies, when they get showed that they're being bullied, that's not a sticking plaster for bullying. That's not going to solve the bullying. I mean, everybody knows what it's like to be bullied, and everybody, I mean, knows probably what it's like to be able to bully. I mean, we're only human; it's a human thing. But these cameras have been used for something else, and also the company involved in supplying the cameras have a parent company that sort of tweets lots about artificial intelligence and education, and that's where I can see the intent of these cameras going.
Because their projections are 5 years ahead about where will this tech go, what do our development needs need to be.
Yeah, well, why would it not? I mean, you're a tech company, why would you not look at that?
Yes.
That's where the market's going. So once, but it's like CCTV, once the cameras are up in public space, they're up.
So what then can people do about this? What can they do? I mean, I'm now really interested in, like, badgering Nottingham City Council and going, what are you doing? What are you doing? So would that be your best guess for you people who are listening and watching this to go, what's my council doing? Be invested, be interested.
Ask a Freedom of Information request. All you need to do is think of a question you need to ask and just email them, or have a look at any of mine, or have a look on the What Do They Know website, and just ask. I always sleep on any questions I want to ask for at least a day, and I always think if I was sat opposite them in a pub, how would it go in a conversation? And I just as simple as that. And then I'd just refine them a bit so it wasn't like a pub conversation, you know. And start asking questions, because if everybody started asking questions, what are these cameras doing? Why are you doing this? How much does that cost? Why do you think this is a good idea? They might just think, well, hang on a minute, it's taking us more time than ever to answer, to be accountable, you know. It's about people being held to account and transparency. And I'm not in the business of telling anybody what to do. If people want to get their fingerprints at school for lunch, is fine. But there are some people who don't want to engage digitally at that sort of level. In fact, there was a report by the Children's Commissioner only, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, saying that children are giving too much digital information out. So I think if your parents start asking the school questions about any computer systems and asking for sort of privacy statements from the school or the company that's running the system, the webcam, some of the companies can access webcams and certainly microphones of computers that school children are using. And for yourself, you could pop off a freedom of information request to Nottingham Council and ask them exactly how long the data for, which company is running it. Is there any analytics that are running it, etc., etc.?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I can see we've been running for quite some time here, my dear.
Oh, yeah, we are. Sorry.
It's absolutely fine. Because I guess the topic is actually pertinent. Every parent, every person who has interest in it, or anyone who has any concerns about any kind of privacy or surveillance that's happening, no matter who you are, whether you're just passing interest or whether you have a child in school, which I guess is most people eventually at some point, is that these questions are going to run through your mind. So to have this conversation, it might well have run over, but it's actually important for people to have that. So thank you. Thank you for taking the time to join me here today. Because I guess it's important. It's understanding the very fabric of society, isn't it? You know, this touches everyone in some way.
Yeah, and I think the Black Mirror episode.
Of course, yes.
Any Black Mirror episode is worth watching.
It is very good. Yeah.
Particularly the one with the social credit system that's now starting to manifest in China, and I suspect, give it another 10 years, we'll have something similar over here.
It is. Yeah, I can just. My thoughts were it's going to track your work progress, your where you go, what you do, how you cross the road, where you shop, how much you spend, your bank loan, how much you're willing to put like on a packet of crisps as opposed to buying an apple. It'll be all tracked together, so you can't use a bus in a well, today you're not going to use your car, you're going to have to walk.
Yeah, you've earned your carbon. Yeah.
Yes.
Interesting, because they have the schools are essentially doing this. I mean, they're tracking where the kids are, what time, when they're not there, what they're doing, what they're eating. They're tracking them what time they're doing their homeworks outside school. There are maths competitions. So this is where the social credit comes in. There are math competitions that you can do where you can beat the time, and then at school on the app there'll be a social score of who's where in the class. And so you get certain people at the top, and then they get trophies, and certain people at the bottom because they're either not doing the homework or they're not very good at maths. And so this social tracking, this credit score, is already sort of coming into the education process. So and of course you start with the next generation, don't you, the one we're too old to be got.
Yes.
So it would be, schools are not in any way, shape or form what we were. Sorry, that's my dog growling around on the floor.
I was saying, is it your stomach?
So ask questions and get interested in what's going on and what tech your children are using at school. That would be a good place to start.
Okay, that always sounds like a great place for us to leave it today. Look, Pippa, it's been fantastic to have you on. I'd love to get you on again very soon. Actually catch up on some of these things that's come past your way in the future. That'd be fantastic.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated. It's been nice.
Thank you very much for taking the time out to join me here today. I really do appreciate it. But if I could just ask one more thing of you, you could just press like, dislike, leave a comment, or press subscribe. You could do any or all of those things, but it allows me to know whether I'm producing the kind of content that you want to listen to. I do produce a variety of content, especially on YouTube and out into the world of social media. So please, if you would, thank you very much. I'm Christian Lander. Until next time.